This is Athens Unpacked. I'm Sofka Zinoviev, and in a series of podcasts, I'm continuing my long quest to understand this fascinating city. Athens Unpacked is made for This Is Athens, the official visitor's guide to the city. If you're speeding along in a taxi and the driver starts crossing himself repeatedly, don't worry. The likely explanation is that you're passing a church. What's more concerning is when there's someone alongside on a motorbike doing the same thing, and smoking, and talking on his phone. But Athenians are nothing if not multitaskers. In this episode, we'll look at the influence of the Greek church in Athens. Whether you're Orthodox or not, its customs become part of your life here, and many of the best and biggest celebrations are linked to religious traditions, like Greek Easter, with its extraordinary range of emotions, from grief to exaltation. Everyone should experience it at least once in their life. Almost anywhere you go in the capital, there's a church nearby. From the imposing 19th century cathedral to jewels like the so-called Little Cathedral that's sitting right next to it. Many of these older Byzantine churches were made using stones and columns from ancient buildings, and frequently they're built over pagan temples. The intimate entwining of historical eras is staggering. You see it in the masonry, but it's also because the invisible elements of faith are continuing through the ages, in the same place, whatever the god. I love going inside churches, especially the smaller ones, and I'm not alone. You see people nipping off the street and taking refuge in the dark, cool interiors. They may be strolling down Ermu or Hermes Street with their carrier bags, and they'll slip into Kapnikarea. This is a 1,000-year-old church that sits bang in the middle of the busiest shopping road in town. Follow them inside, and they'll probably light a slender beeswax candle, and they'll say a quick prayer before an icon of the Panagia, or Virgin Mary, to whom the place is dedicated. As your eyes get accustomed, you notice the frescoes of haloed saints and the glint of gilded mosaics. You smell the incense, and it's almost impossible not to be moved. For many centuries, Orthodox Christianity was at the heart of what it meant to be Greek. And irrespective of piety, people are still tightly bound to church traditions. Civil weddings were legalized in the mid-80s when the old system of dowries was also banned. But the majority of Athenians still choose a priest to preside over their nuptials. Similarly, few babies are left unbaptized. They're not even considered properly named until they've been dipped in the font. One of my Greek nephews was known as Bobolone, a sort of creamy Italian doughnut, until he was finally baptized as a walking, talking child. As in life, so in death. There's been a breakaway from the Orthodox ban on cremation, and recently Greece's first crematorium opened north of Athens. But the old traditions of burial die hard. Sorry. A black-hatted priest and a sanctified grave is still how most people choose to bid farewell to those they love. To get an idea about death in the city, we're going to the finest and most famous graveyard. It was built when Athens became the capital in the 1830s. I'm going to meet the magnificent American poet A.E. Stallings. Alicia has been in Athens for over 20 years. She lives here with her Greek journalist husband and their two children, just down the road from the First Cemetery. She's a multi-award-winning poet and a translator and a critic. She's been a Pulitzer finalist and she's received a MacArthur Foundation so-called genius grant. And amidst all this, she's volunteered for many years with refugees. This is obviously a place of great sadness. We come here to bury people who are cherished, but it's also a bit like a beautiful park. We see lovely sculptures and all kinds of things.
It is really a sculpture garden. Some of the most famous Greek sculptors, including Halepas, have work here. So in some ways, it's almost like a museum. And those sculptors are in turn buried here. And to me, I think I often feel maybe comforted by being here. Maybe it's the long view of mortality. But I think the main emotion I get here is love. I feel that these stones are about loving and remembering people and about one generation talking to another.
There's sometimes also playfulness. I mean, I think during lockdown, it has been a place where people have come to breathe some fresh air.
Certainly. I mean, this is it's a great place for a date, you know, to walk. There's a beautiful view of the Acropolis, if you know the secret way to get to it. You would see young people, I think, who weren't usually going to come to a cemetery would come and they were looking for certain graves or they were just walking around. Kids would come in the evening and the guards would kind of turn a blind eye as they skateboarded in the center, which is this wonderful paved section of the cemetery.
As we're walking around, we're stopping in front of various fantastic sculptures, and we've just stopped here by this chap in a hat. What do you make of him?
I really love this fellow. He's got such a wonderful self-pleased air. He's got his hat at a rakish angle. He's got a wonderful mustache and a cravat. He seems to have a lot of personality. I have no idea who he is, but there are many things like that. I often think it would be great to do a sort of scavenger hunt and give people a list, you know, find a wonderful mustache, find a beautiful sphinx. There are so many wonderful images and sculptures like this that are just odd.
You've said that you could write a history of modern Greece through the funerals of the poets buried here. What did you mean by that?
Well, there are two particular funerals that punctuated modern Greek history that were the funerals of poets. The first is Kostis Palamas, who's kind of a national Greek poet, and he died during the German occupation. So when his funeral happened, it was a way for people to gather and protest that occupation under the guise of honoring this poet. And then again, when Greece was under a dictatorship, you had the Nobel Prize-winning poet George Seferis die. And again, that funeral had something like 100,000 people, was itself a catalyst, a way of marking displeasure with the authorities.
That was a recording of Seferis's funeral. The crowd is shouting Athanatos, or immortal, in reference to the poet's standing. Then they chant Eleftheria, Dimokratia, freedom, democracy. The crowd also sang a song by Theodoraikis. The lyrics are a poem by Seferis called Denial. It became a resistance anthem during the junta, and here it is, sung by the great Grigoris Pithikotsis. We've We've just come close to the main gate now, and this is where some of the big stars are buried. Who do we find around here?
Well, we have prime ministers, we have archbishops. We're standing next to Melina Mercouri's monument, which is large in terms of real estate, but I think relatively modest compared to some of the fantastic sculpture around us. She has a kind of severe stone. Of course, she's a movie star, but was also famous as culture minister for her efforts to get the Elgin marbles repatriated to Greece. So the stone has a kind of, I think, almost Parthenon marble kind of severity to it.
And her husband is right around the back.
Yes, Jules Dassin has a kind of private apartment, a little separate entrance in the back of the tomb. So it's actually not only Melina Mercouri's tomb.
Just a reminder that Connecticut-born Jules Dassin was famous in his own right. Among the many films he directed was Never on Sunday. In it, he also acts. He's the innocent, if intellectual, American to Mercouri's open-hearted Piraeus prostitute. We've stopped in front of one of the more famous sculptures in the cemetery.
This is called the Sleeping Beauty. It is the tombstone of Sofia Afendaki, who died at 18 years old. And it's a beautiful sculpture. She's reclined on a pillow, clutching a cross to her breast, but she looks like she's asleep and almost as if she's breathing. The detail and the lifelikeness are amazing. Visitors to the cemetery always stop by her grave, and someone always has put a fresh flower in one of her open hands, so that's very lovely. She's the work of a very famous Greek sculptor, Halepas, who is a marble worker from the island of Tinos, which is famous for its marble workers. And he is buried around the corner from her.
We're moving between the sublime, the ridiculous, and the humorous with every step we take. I mean, it's an amazing range of emotions.
Right now we're standing before one of the male angels here, who is nude with a bit of drapery in the important places. And he has a startling resemblance to me to Benedict Cumberbatch. I don't know if we all agree to that.
And in this quiet spot where all we can really hear are the birds singing and a little rumble in the distance, you're going to read us one of your poems.
Mornings I walk past the first cemetery of Athens. Like a widow every day, the gray dawn comes to the proto-necrotaphio and sweeps the crumbs of night from tombstones and the marble busts. The stonecutter in his workshop contemplates, chisel in hand, the blank face of clean slates. The waitress at the cafe mops and dusts. A priest sits at his newspaper and tarries over the headlines and obituaries. Soon the mourners gather there to drain the thick black liquid to the bitter grain. At the office of endings, a hunched man taps his thumbs. Four diggers play a hand of cards to kill a little time. Two withered florists fill the old foam wreaths with new chrysanthemums.
After saying goodbye to Alicia, I wandered down onto Anapafsios, the street of eternal repose. It's busy with flower shops and marble carvers, trades that have always accompanied Athenian death. In fact, for those interested in the long view, I'd recommend the Keramikos Cemetery. It dates back millennia and is one of the prettiest ancient sites and one of the least well-known. Keramikos is named after the area where the potters or ceramicists lived. Like the modern First Cemetery, it's a tranquil and fascinating sculpture park. On Anapafsios Street, I paused outside what looks like a pastry shop. Only all the cakes are formal and white, a bit like the base of wedding cakes. And they're decorated with sugared almonds and sometimes a name. This is Papios, the most famous confectioners of koliva, or food for remembering the dead. Traditionally, koliva was made at home for memorials. These mnemosyna take place 3 days, 9 days, 40 days, and a year after any death. You boil wheat, an ingredient symbolic of the resurrection. and you add pomegranate seeds, something associated with death's presence in life, since Persephone ate them and condemned herself to spending half the year in Hades. Coliver also includes sugar, spices, parsley, and nuts. And some version or another has been handed out to mourners for as long as anyone knows. To find out more, I went inside Papias to meet Dimitris Papias. Athenians became too busy to make their own, he explained. And now he's the fourth generation of Coliver confectioner since the family business started in 1925. I asked whether they'd provided Coliver for any famous names and learnt how many of the great and the good of Athens are their clients.
Όλα τα μνημόσυνα σχεδόν.
I asked for an example and was given a list of prime ministers, kings, a general, and Melina Mercouri.
Για παράδειγμα.
Για παράδειγμα, Πλαστήρας, Παπάγος, Παπανδρέου, Καραμαλής, Μελίνα Μερκούρη, Ανδρέας Παπανδρέου, έτσι, Γεώργιος Παπανδρέου, όλοι.
Coliver is normally handed out in a paper bag with a little spoon. And as we left, Dimitris offered us some as a snack. Apparently, people regularly drop in for a breakfast portion. Classic with sugar, he asked, or with stevia? Some aspects of Orthodox Christianity are obvious in Athens, like the churches or the tombs. But there's a whole network of relationships that the casual visitor won't spot. It's what anthropologists call spiritual kinship. And however modern life gets, it's still fundamental to Athenians. It covers the relationship of godparents with godchildren and their entire families, but also with the kumbaros or kumbara, the person who acts as best man or woman and holds the wreath crowns at a marriage. So I'm going to ring up my kumbara, Georgina Solo. I met her when we overlapped at the same school in Oxford, aged about 17. I'm afraid we were both amongst the naughty girls. She'd come over from Aegina, an island right next to Athens where she'd been brought up. Georgina went on to become a puppeteer and then an artist and set designer. She now lives mostly in Crete and makes astonishingly complex and lovely lanterns for festivals.
Γεια σου, Κουμπάρα.
Γεια σου, Κουμπάρα μου. Τι κάνεις?
Καλά, εσύ.
How are you?
Very well. Very well, thank you. And you?
I'm fine, thank you. So we're talking about kumbari today and the bond between us, kumbari. Why is it seen as sacred? What does it mean to you?
Well, you tie yourself to another family for lifelong tie, and it's a great honour to be asked to be a nonna or a godmother, and a great responsibility as well. It takes place in church, the baptism, if you're a kumbara, a best man or woman to a marriage. And the ritual is seen as a mysterio, which is a mystery. So some mysterious force happens within the church that creates this deep connection between the kumbaro and the child or the couple. And the ties are that important that if you have multiple godchildren, they are considered to be siblings and can never marry.
When you named your daughter after me and you asked me to become her godmother, it came with honour and glory, but there are also expectations. So we godparents have duties, don't we?
The main duty is a spiritual duty, to be seen as the child's spiritual mother and to care for the child's spiritual well-being. So it's a lovely thing. It's like a lifelong connection.
It is. And I'm thinking about what actually happens at the baptism. It's quite an intense ceremony.
The birth mother has to go to the back of the church and not be involved with the child during the actual ritual. And the godmother or godfather has to hold the baby. The baby is completely naked, plunged into the water 3 times, often headfirst for the final dunk in the font.
We've all lived through that.
It can be very traumatic. And then the baby's also fully oiled, so it's very slippery when it comes out of the font and wriggling. And then you have to hold it and try and pacify it and dress it. And you've provided the gold cross to put around its neck and really fancy sort of baptismal clothes. So it can be quite stressful dealing with the baby as a godparent, but it's a wonderful thing.
And the kumbarus, the kumbara, whether it's a best man or woman or a godparent of your child, it's a very close relationship, isn't it? And you recently sent me this marvellous song.
O kumbaros, o kumbaros, me sto spiti benno vigenia fomentaro. I kumbara ire mega stiradmos, son kumbaro trigirisi a timetaros.
The song I found because there's an expression that I know from way back, which is Okumbaros ke kumbara tris foresti nevromada, which means kumbaros and kumbara do it 3 times a week. And so there's always been this hint at extramarital affairs. And there's a song from the 1930s by Hunaris, who was a contemporary of my dad. My dad was a crooner as well in the 30s, called George Dracul.
He was very famous at the time, wasn't he, your dad?
He was very famous, and he brought out lots of records, and he was sung with Atik and Vembo and Hunaris and all the big stars at that time. But they obviously had this genre of comedy songs, and I found this great song by Hunaris called O Kumbaros, and it refers to all the affairs that kumbari have, and some of the lyrics are hilarious.
Occasionally, an adult is baptized into the Orthodox Church, usually because they're not Greek. I'm going to see Chris Humphreys to find out about his experience. Chris is a British cellist with a prestigious Athenian orchestra. More on that in the next episode. He's married to a Greek, and we're meeting near where he lives in central Athens. It's an area named after one of the biggest churches in the Balkans, Agios Pandelaimonas. We're inside the huge church of Agios Pandelaimonas, which is where, Chris, I think you had a very interesting experience some years back.
It wasn't something I would have ever dreamed of, but in order to get married where I wanted to, in a church on the island of Naxos, I first needed to be baptised. And I thought I would come here, sign a couple of bits of paper in a small office, and that would be that. I would be Orthodox. But no, my wife organised it behind my back to the point where she brought all the necessary equipment, which included a swimming costume, towels, etc. And I walked in here accompanied by a few family and friends and had to go through a full baptism in the centre of this giant dome, which we're stood underneath right now, which involved climbing into this enormous cauldron-like pot full of water and then having oil poured over my head, which was great, except that when you are in a vat of oily water and they then ask you to get out, it's almost impossible. I was like a cat stuck in the bath.
I'm trying not to laugh too loudly because there's not a service going on, but there are people having their own private prayers, going round, kissing icons, lighting candles. It's a very special atmosphere in any Greek church, with the smell of frankincense and the beeswax candles. But here, with its giant size, apparently one of the biggest Orthodox churches in the Balkans, it's particularly impressive. Mm-hmm. Chris didn't mention whether he had a godparent, but that would have brought them a lifetime of responsibility, as Mai Kumbara mentioned. At Easter, not only do they provide the lambada, or decorated candle, but new shoes, a gift, and possibly money. Above all, he or she must remember the godchild's name day, the day your saint is celebrated. Naturally, everyone with the same name shares a name day, and there are certain dates in the calendar where Athenians must run through their contacts and make dozens of calls if it's a common name like Yorgos, George, or Eleni, Helen. When we first moved to Athens, my daughters were 5 and 8, and we'd never made much of a fuss about name days in Rome or London. But here, they'd returned from school complaining that one classmate or another came in bearing boxes of cakes or chocolates and handed them around to everyone for their name day. It was easy with Anna, 9th of December, with all the other Annas. Lara was harder, but St. Larissa turned out to be on the 26th of March, and she was soon able to celebrate both her birthday and her name day along with everyone else. Even an Agamemnon or an Antigone has their day, and at the very worst, All Saints' Day comes into play. When I first lived in Greece, I was intrigued by how the person celebrating is the one who gives, from handing out sweets to paying for your friends if you go out for dinner. This is part of the hardwired impulse of Greeks to offer hospitality and gifts. You may notice Athenians having ferocious rows over the bill at a taverna, but don't imagine it's about who should contribute less, as it may be elsewhere in Europe. Here, it's always a competition over who can pay it all. Many a fake trip to the toilet disguises a sneaky settling of finances. And the beneficiary of this generosity won't say thank you, but will growl, "Well, next time it's mine." There's a hilarious sketch by the fabulous stand-up comedian Katerina Vrana, who performs in both English and Greek, though I only found this in Greek. She's ruthless on how in England people fuss over who ate less and who should therefore pay less, while in Greece this is what ensues when the waiter announces that the bill has already been settled by their friend.
Έλα τώρα! Με φύγεις! Όχι, το πλούσες εσύ περασμένη φορά! Δεν γίνεται καν κατάσταση αυτή! Έτσι δεν είναι.
Anthropologists argue that hospitality and giving gifts is a way of gaining status, of getting the upper hand in a relationship, or of setting up an expectation of reciprocity. Offer the stranger food and drink, and you never know. At the very least, do as you would be done by, and you might expect the same when travelling. Greeks argue they've been acting like this since Homeric times. The relationships and rituals of the church are deeply entwined with older customs and beliefs. Having the evil eye removed in a little home ceremony combines Christian prayer and the belief that an envious glance in the street can provoke nausea or aches. You may notice babies with a little glass eye pinned onto their clothes. It's a precautionary tactic against admiring glances. And whether or not they know how useful they are, tourists love these as trinkets. Souvenir shops are stuffed with a huge variety, and I highly recommend buying as many as possible. I realise I was ridiculously ambitious by even attempting to look at the significance of Greek Orthodoxy in Athens, and in under half an hour. But I'll try to cover almost as much next time in the final episode. Unpacking the wildly varied art scene, we'll learn about the massive cultural foundations of Onassis and Niarchos, and how these famous shipowners were once rivals in love and life. We'll talk to a cellist from the prize-winning Camerata Orchestra, and we'll go in search of street art and buskers. I am Sofka Zinoviev, and you just listened to Athens Unpacked for This Is Athens, the official visitor's guide to the city of Athens, online at thisisathens.org. You can find all episodes of Athens Unpacked on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any of your favorite podcast apps. Athens Unpacked is a production of pod.gr. Thanks to Katerina Bakoyani for her endless support. Producer, Michalis Kamakas. Sound engineer, Chrisa Kurenda. Director of Productions, Elena Dimitraiki. Assistant producer, Lara Papadimitriou. Original theme music by Anna Papadimitriou. This podcast is funded by Greece and the European Union. Pod.gr. Sounds good.